This meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will now come to order. The time is now 1:02 p.m. on Monday, March 9th, 2026. We are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. The following members are present: Representative Eichheit, Representative Vance, Representative Mina, and myself, Representative Gray Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I would like to recognize the staff supporting this meeting: Sophia Tenney from House Records, Kyla Tupo from the Juno LIO, and my committee aide, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez. We have one item of business on today's agenda: an informational hearing on the topic of civil protective orders, survivor safety, and potential improvements. Today, we will hear from three presenters: Laura Booch, a constituent from District 5, who will share her personal experience with civil protective orders; Dr. Ingrid Johnson, an associate professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, who will speak about how civil protective orders serve as important tools for the short and long-term health and safety of survivors of domestic violence; and Christine Pate, the legal program director for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, who will present on civil protective orders for victims in Alaska. We will now hear from our first presenter. Ms. Booch, would you please come to the front, state your name for the record, and begin your testimony. You can move the microphone.
Okay. My name is Laura Booch, and do I need to state anything else?
You can say that you're from House District 5.
Okay, yeah. I'm from District 5. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I grew up in Kodiak. I lived in Anchorage for about 18 years until I returned home with my three kids in 2021. So, first of all, I just want to thank you all for even being here to listen to me share this, and for giving us a platform to discuss how important this is. Thank you. So I grew up in Kodiak, and I moved to Anchorage in 2002, and almost immediately became trapped in a long-term domestic violence relationship that only ended in 2021, when my three youngest, very frightened children and I returned home to Kodiak after getting another protective order. And we stayed at the KWRCC shelter until we got back on our feet. I've maintained a long-term DVPO since leaving 5 years ago. However, every year I am required to reopen the case, serve my abuser, and attend another hearing just to keep the protections in place. And nothing has changed. There's no effort to change behavior on the abuser's part, so everything is still the same, but I still have to engage with him. Each filing triggers conflict and escalations that come out in all kinds of different ways. It gives him a platform to continue exerting power and control through the legal system as well, because even though the filings may be baseless or the things that he say have no merit, I still have to read them and I still have to respond to them. And I'm still thrown back into this place that I have been working very hard to heal from. So, sorry. So since we have children and the court found very clear findings of domestic violence, well beyond the statutory minimum was the wording, it triggered the presumption against custody, where the things have to be, you know, certain requirements need to be met, like a batterer's intervention program and, you know, counseling and things to show that change is being made before that order can be modified. But the kids aren't even on the protective order. It's just me. So when I'm doing this each year, it's just throwing me back into this place where I'm engaging with him and having to relive the abuse and giving him a platform to interrogate me. Even when it's through a judge, it's still the same tone and the same, I feel the same way, regardless of whether I'm on the phone or going through a judge or in person, or it's just, it's very difficult. It also, you know, it exhausts my emotional bandwidth and a lot of the time and energy that I could be devoting towards my children, enjoying the beautiful life that I have now with my, you know, my wonderful, supportive new husband and, you know, our pets and our beautiful home and all of the things that we enjoy doing together as a family in Kodiak. It becomes difficult to even feel like I can be present in my own life when I am being forced to constantly re-engage with the past just to keep basic protections in place. So the courts have been amazing. The judges that have handled all of the DVPO hearings and all of the filings, they've applied the law as it's written. They've been very fair to both of us. It's just the process is extremely taxing for me as the petitioner who has to continually engage with this person, and I don't know when it ends. Our youngest child is 10, so at least 8 more years if nothing changes. So I appreciate you being willing to listen to the struggle and discuss it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Booch, for sharing your experience today. Are there any questions for Ms. Booch from committee members? Oh, Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray, through the chair. I don't have a question. I just wanted to thank you for just sharing your experience and just how heavy it is to go through that process. And I'm sorry for what you have gone through. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll also state for the record that we were joined by Representative Underwood at 1:04 p.m. Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray, through the chair, Ms. Booch. Thank you for being here. I guess the question I would have from where you sit in your experience, what would make the system better for you and folks in your situation?
Well, for me personally, it took me over 15 years and 5 or 6 different attempts to leave before I finally was able to get out, file for the first DVPO, and, you know, start moving on with my life. And it's as difficult as it is to get to that place, it would just be really nice if the burden was on the respondent to prove that the situation has changed versus me having to prove that my fear is still reasonable. You know, because even if I'm, you know, doing a lot better and he's an ocean away from me, I'm working through all of that. And then I have to go tell him I'm still afraid of him. And that feels, I don't know, it doesn't feel like it's very empowering. So shifting the burden would be what I would ask.
Any other questions for our presenter? I'll ask one. I might be getting ahead of myself with our next presenters, but do you know about, you know, other options in terms of not having to do it every year, what other states have done?
I have done some research, yeah, and I have seen that, you know, there are several states that have, I think it was New Jersey that has a similar, like the petitioner keeps the order in place and it's the burden is on the respondent to show that a certain number of specific requirements have been met before. And one of them has to be that the respondent or the petitioner agrees, I believe, that they don't fear the respondent anymore. I think it's California that has like a 5-year. And then, you know, I know there's some states that even have permanent, like lifelong DVPOs. And so with Alaska having, you know, such a problem that we do with domestic violence and violence in general, just feels a little backward.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Thank you. We will now hear from our second presenter, Raised in Delta Junction in Fairbanks, Dr. Johnson received her BA in Justice from UAF and completed both an MA and PhD in Criminal Justice at Temple University in Philadelphia. She taught and conducted research as a professor in the University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center from 2018 to 2024. In 2024, she returned to Interior Alaska to join the UAF Department of Justice. The focus of much of Dr. Johnson's research is on help-seeking and justice needs among survivors of sexual assault and intimate partner violence, and how formal and informal networks can improve those processes. She is also expanding her research into violence prevention and has expertise in the areas of rural-urban differences, substance use and treatment access, and restorative justice. Dr. Johnson, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Dr. Ingrid Johnson from Fairbanks. Thank you to the committee for having me. So that was quite emotional testimony from Ms. Booch. I'll be giving the very macro view of both domestic violence in the state of Alaska, and then also some data on civil protective orders. So I did prepare a handout that you all have access to, and I believe there's printouts if you didn't see it digitally. I did forget to put at the top the actual statistics on domestic violence against women in Alaska. That's something that I'm just so used to presenting that it did kind of escape me. So I do want to start with those, but they're not actually on the fact sheet. So the main way that we know about the rates of intimate partner violence or partner abuse in the state of Alaska is through the Alaska Victimization Survey. I was the principal investigator for that in 2020 when I was still at the Justice Center at UAA. So the latest data that we have from 2020 are that 70% of women in Alaska have experienced partner abuse. That's psychological aggression, coercive control and entrapment behaviors, and physical abuse. So I think most important for our discussion today, obviously, physical violence is one of the main ways people think about intimate partner abuse, but the coercive control and entrapment behaviors are really important here. So those include behaviors like controlling what a partner can do, where they can go, who they can associate with, how they spend their money, attempts at reproductive control, all kinds of different behaviors aimed around controlling a partner's life. So 60% of adult Alaskan women have experienced coercive control and entrapment behaviors in their lifetime. And 68% have experienced psychological aggression, and then 47% physical violence. So multiple women have experienced some combination of those, so that adds up to 70%, right? So that's 7 out of 10, however you want to break that down. It's a lot of women in Alaska have had these experiences. Also, this data does not come from the AVS, which only measures victims who are still alive, but Alaska has the highest rate of women killed by men in the country. We're actually twice the national average. So we do have a significant problem with violence against women, both in terms of the non-fatal violence and fatal violence. So that, again, those statistics are not in the handout, but just to sort of premise this discussion. So civil protective orders are the primary survivor-driven legal mechanism for dealing with intimate partner abuse. So when I say survivor-driven, I mean when a victim reports to the criminal justice system, all of the decisions after that are essentially made by other actors. They're made by the police, the prosecutors. They might consult, and they often do consult with victims, right? But I'm sorry, I use the terms victim and survivor interchangeably. So they may consult with them, but the survivors are not the ones making the decisions about that process. Whereas civil protective orders, they don't obviously decide whether they're granted, but they're deciding whether they want to pursue further orders, long-term orders, continue their long-term order. They're also the primary civil mechanism because tort law or suing their abusers is often inaccessible. It's too expensive. Lawyers often won't take those cases if there's not going to be the expectation that they're going to get money from that case. So really, civil protective orders are the most accessible form of some kind of formal intervention in their abusive situation. When we look to the data from 2024, we see that almost 7,900 civil protective order cases were filed. So they are quite widely used in the state of Alaska. I think it's worth noting that petitioners do this for more than just safety reasons. Safety is obviously a big part of it, but it's also moving forward with their lives, feeling more at peace, actually making the abuser realize how badly they've treated them and their families. And I think that's just important from an empowerment perspective. We know that abuse is a very disempowering experience. Coercive control and entrapment behaviors in particular are about power and control and about making the victim feel powerless and feel at the will of the abuser. So protective orders in many ways are an empowerment tool as well as a safety tool. As far as the research on whether they work, we can think about whether they work in a number of different ways. We can think about, do they reduce repeat incidents with violence? And then how do they make victims, survivors feel? And so what we can see is that there's some mixed findings about whether they reduce repeat incidents of both physical and psychological abuse. And so when I say mixed, obviously, when you look at the research on any topic, there's going to be some studies that find an effect and others that don't. And there can be kind of differences in the effect sizes that they find. So it would appear that they either have a positive effect, and positive in this case, meaning that they do reduce repeat incidents of physical and psychological abuse, or they have a neutral effect or no effect, right? But not necessarily the opposite direction, like that they increase violence. There will be individual cases where that is the case, but on the whole, right, the research is finding that they either reduce repeat violence or have no effect. There's also research on how they make victim survivors feel. So that research is more consistent. They do improve well-being, physical and mental health. And we could say that's probably largely related to the fact that they decrease perceptions of fear and increase perceptions of feeling safer, right? And so if somebody does not have to live in fear and doesn't have to feel that their safety is at risk, they're obviously going to have better physical and mental health. And so related to that, we actually can see that these are cost savers for society. This study, they didn't state it explicitly, but when you dig around, you can see that it was done in Kentucky. They did a cost benefit of CPOs, and they estimated that it saved Kentucky tens of millions of dollars in a one-year period, primarily in health-related costs. Again, related to those lower perceptions of fear, increased perceptions of feeling safer, and higher levels of well-being. I also want to emphasize just the research on the persistence of certain abusers, long-term abusers. So many abuse survivors experience stalking by their ex-partners post-separation. So I have 50 to 75. I was looking at a systematic review. And so they were looking at a variety of different studies, and the estimates were between 50 and 75 experiencing that abuse after they've left the abusive partner. And then I was able to locate a study that actually looked at the duration of that violence. It was a third of those victims who had experienced that continuation of abuse experienced it beyond 1 year. So 50 to 75% experiencing this post-relationship, and then a third of those experiencing it for longer than a year. So there's not as much research on the extension of civil protective orders and the effects of that, but there are other research findings that can kind of inform what it would be like and the importance of having longer-term civil protective orders. One study found that 25% of women did not return to court for a permanent protective order after being granted a temporary order. So that's a quarter. And of course, we don't know why, right? Like, we don't know if they just decided it wasn't necessary or for other reasons. But we could also assume there was some there are some reasons about potentially the hassle or the inconvenience or the fear of having to go back in and face their abusers. And what we know very consistently from the help-seeking literature more broadly is that when victim survivors have a negative experience with help-seeking, so whether they feel that their needs were not adequately addressed, if they feel blamed or shamed or any number of different negative interactions, that that reduces their likelihood of then seeking help in the future. And so when we really struggle to get victims in our state to reach out and get the help they need, this essentially creates another barrier of making them re-engage with their abusers, as we very powerfully heard from Ms. Booch. Thank you. I'll take questions now.
Thank you, Dr. Johnson. Let the record reflect that we were joined by Representative Costello at 1:14 p.m. Are there any questions from committee for Dr. Johnson? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Ms. Sherman. And I wanted to get the prior speaker out of the hot seat because she did a fantastic job. You had talked about, you know, how this helps well-being and lack of fear. But can you paint the picture for people who are not as familiar with this of what the life of a survivor will look like if they don't seek a protective order and go through the hassle? And what that life looks like versus trying to put this in place to make sure that they have some sort of safety protection.
I mean, I'm much better at statistics than I am at those experiences. I'm almost wondering if I could defer to our next testimony, who has more direct experience, at least working in the advocacy side of things. Because I feel like I could, again, speak to like what are statistics on who experiences violence and things like that, but I don't have a victim advocacy experience working with survivors directly.
That's very fair. Thank you.
Representative Underwood.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I don't know if this would be for you or for the next person coming up, but when it comes to statistics, when you have the 7,900 CPOs that were in 2024, do you kind of roughly know geographically? I was just researching a little bit on just access. I know in rural for filing is potentially a lot more difficult than somebody in the urban when it comes to court access. And what do we know? How many of those 7,900 are kind of broken up for rural to urban?
I could look at that. I don't know. I got that number is from the court's annual report, and I don't know if they break it out by region. They very well could because it's a very long report.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question, Dr. Johnson. When you mentioned at the beginning of your talk about Alaska having the highest rates of homicide for women, do we know that civil protective orders prevent homicides?
We know that they reduce repeat incidents of physical and psychological abuse. I'm not sure if anybody has looked at whether they reduce homicides. I'm just trying to think. Among the studies I was looking at, I think they were looking at non-fatal violence largely. So I don't know.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee? Representative Costello.
Thank you. When a victim is killed, is that usually preceded by a civil protective order or prior domestic violence situation or incidents?
When they're killed by an intimate partner, it's certainly preceded by other incidents of domestic violence. I do not know about whether there are protective orders. I'm trying to think of, I think when I get asked these questions, then I try to think of how I would locate this research. But as far as the research I looked at, I did not see anything that mentioned that.
Thank you. I think we'll go to our next presenter. Thank you so much, Dr. Johnson. We'll now hear from our third and final presenter. Christine Pate is the Legal Program Director for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Ms. Pate, if you will take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Let me share my screen because I do have a presentation.
Perfect. We can see it.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak on the topic of civil protection orders for survivors. My name for the record is Christine Pate. I am the Legal Program Director for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I've been in this position for over 25 years. I've been working with survivors in the civil legal process for over 30 years. What I do at the network is both run our direct services program, where we serve survivors statewide who need help with civil issues, whether that is family law, protection orders, housing issues, and we provide attorney assistance to them. And then we also provide training and technical assistance to the advocates at our member program statewide who are doing work in their areas, specifically with survivors. And this is just a overview of where our member programs are. The Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, as many of you know, is the statewide coalition that has 24 member programs. Our executive director, Brenda Stanfill, I know is there in the room. They provide a myriad services around the state for survivors, including legal assistance, and that is primarily through advocates, not attorneys, who are in their programs. If attorney assistance is needed, it gets referred to our program to provide that assistance, which we do through a small program, which includes 3 staff attorneys and 2 paralegals, and then many of our cases go out to contractors or volunteer attorneys. So in this presentation, I'm hoping to do really 3 things. Talk a little bit, I want to continue with the discussion that Dr. Johnson just had with you about the importance of civil protective orders, why we have them, and maybe address some misconceptions that in my work I've heard about these orders. I want to talk about the nuts and bolts of how a civil protection order in Alaska actually works, and then end with some thoughts about ideas for changing the law or improving the law for victims. And I really want to thank Ms. Booch for coming forward. We know how hard it is for a survivor to come forward and tell their story repeatedly. She shows a lot of courage in doing this, and I appreciate that. And thank you to the committee for taking so much time today to learn about this. So this is just a quote from one of our clients recently about the importance of a civil protective order to them and how it helped them in the moment when they had to reach out and they were being terrorized by the person who lived with them, who was also the father of their child. What we know about civil protective orders is they are often the person's first, a survivor's first access to the justice system. It's the first time they've reached out for help. They will go to one of our member programs and they will learn about this process. And it's really important that it's a good process because, as you just heard from Dr. Johnson and from Ms. Booch, people stay in these relationships for a long time often because there are so many obstacles. And if when they reach out, It is not a trauma-informed, accessible, easy process for them. They won't reach out again. So very important for the system to be made accessible for folks. So we often hear, why do people stay in these relationships? Why doesn't somebody just get up and leave? And what we know is that people stay for many reasons. These are some of them. I want to highlight, I think, four of these, which are important, which is safety concerns, housing, children, and financial constraints. What we know is that a civil protection order offers the remedies immediately that somebody can access to overcome these obstacles. So if the research shows us that separation is the time of highest lethality for a victim, we know that getting a protective order that includes no contact provisions can get them the remedy they need to leave the relationship. If we know that housing, especially in our state where housing is at such a premium and is so expensive, if that's a reason why people stay in relationships, you can get your possession of the residence by getting a civil protection order. If we know that people stay because they've been told repeatedly for years that if they leave, the abusive person will keep their children and they will never have access to them, then we know that getting a protective order can help them to get access and temporary custody of their children so they can feel that their children are safe. And then financial constraints is a huge concern for folks. They stay with their abuser because that person is the main breadwinner, because they have been isolated, as we just heard from Dr. Johnson, financially. They've been cut off from the financial resources. And so getting a civil protective order can, in the short term, help somebody to get child support or spousal support or other financial needs that they may have to stay safe. So it's a really critical tool in the process. Having been in this field for many years and been involved over the years with some of the legislative changes that we've seen, these are some of the things we've heard over time. It's really easy to get a protective order. People do it to get a leg up in custody court or divorce. Firearms are automatically taken if you have a protection order issued against you. Or most domestic violence is litigated in criminal court, or most victims call the police. So I want to, in my presentation, touch on some of these. I'm not going to immediately dispel them, but I'd like to go through some of these because what we find is that these are not true. First of all, again, this is something that Dr. Johnson touched on, but it's important to kind of understand how a civil protection order is different from a criminal case. We believe and understand that the criminal justice process is a critically important one for ending domestic violence in people's lives. But the civil process actually has many advantages and is very different and important for a survivor. And a few reasons about that include that it is the person, again, the person who brings the case is the survivor and not the police or the DA. So there's empowerment, as you just heard. It's like the victim can go forward with the case, but if they feel like, I want to try again, I'm not feeling safe, I'm not feeling comfortable, they can decide to dismiss or withdraw the petition. Once you call the police in a criminal manner, the criminal justice system takes over, whether you want it to or not. And we know that some people are not comfortable accessing the criminal justice system. The research shows that less than 50% of victims ever access the criminal justice system because they may not want their abuser to be arrested. That may be the person who's bringing home the paycheck. They may have fear of law enforcement. Other differences are in the remedies. A civil protection order, as I'll explain in a few minutes here, is a much broader remedy in terms of what you can get. You can get in the criminal justice system, you can get incarceration and maybe some restitution, many more remedies involved in civil protective orders. Right to counsel. This is probably one where there is not a great edge in the civil justice system because we know there's no right to counsel in the civil justice system in general, but certainly in the protective order world. In civil protective orders, a survivor generally is going to court by themselves. The great amount of cases are done pro se or by a person who doesn't have an attorney. You can imagine how difficult that might be, having just heard from Ms. Booch, if you're going to court and you don't even have an attorney helping to guide you through the system. Our program is one of a very small patchwork of programs that provide civil legal assistance in these cases, but there's still always the need for more folks to be doing it.
Ms. Pate.
And sources, yeah.
Does Alaska Legal Services provide any counsel for folks seeking civil protective orders?
Yes, thank you, Representative Gray. They do. They absolutely do. But I know that they are not able to meet the need, and you've probably heard that from Ms. Hum, their executive director. So all of us know that I think the statistic I'm going to tell you is it's only about 10% of cases where there is representation on one side or another of an attorney in these cases. And other than us, there's maybe a couple of our member programs that have attorneys in their programs, and then Alaska Native Justice Center has one attorney in Anchorage. And that's basically it for attorneys around the state who are able to provide assistance. And then evidence and privacy. In a criminal case, all evidence that is in the prosecutor's hands has to be turned over to the defense attorney. And that can be a real detriment for a survivor to move forward. In the civil case, you have a little bit more control over your privacy and your information. So those are some of the differences and some of the reasons we think that the protective order process is a critical and needed process for survivors. These are some statistics from the last half of 2025. So these are 6 months of stats for protective orders in Alaska. And I think the numbers are pretty telling in terms of how easy it is to get a protective order. So this graph shows that for a 6 month period of time, and I'm sorry, it's so tiny on my screen, but there were, this is the domestic violence, because we also have stalking and sexual assault protective orders. But for civil domestic violence protective orders, almost 3,000 were sought of the ex parte or the short term orders, but only 1,302 were actually granted. So that is less than half were granted. And that's 46% of short terms were actually granted, and 17% of the long terms were granted. So that's less than 1 in 5 people who sought a long-term order actually received one in the long term.
Can I ask why? Can you tell why so few are granted?
I think that is a great question, but I would say there's many factors that go into that. There's probably a world of people that don't go forward with the long-term order, and I don't have that nuance in this statistic. But I think there also is, it's rigorous. You have to prove that a crime of domestic violence occurred. They're often, you may be as the victim against an attorney on the other side, because we know that respondents often sometimes have more resources and access to an attorney. It's not an easy process, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a minute, but it is not like these are just given out very easily, even at the short-term process where you don't even have the other side that is there to contest the case.
Thank you.
And just, I want to point out the stat there on the emergency orders, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, but there was only one of those even asked for, or two, excuse me, and granted. These are sexual assault protective orders, which is a different type of order where there's no household relationship. And these were granted. There's very few of these in the state, but 31 of the short terms were asked for, 16 granted, and 32 long terms requested, and 5, I think it says there, were actually ordered. So that's 35% of short terms granted and 52% of short term granted and 19% of long term were granted in the sexual assault protective order realm. And then for Stalking protective orders, again, for someone who doesn't know their respondent and is being stalked, very low statistics on this one. We show that for the short term, 35% of short term were granted and 14% of the long term orders were granted. So very difficult to get those orders. Okay, what are we talking about when we talk about these orders? Okay, actually, before I get into this, we have a wonderful resource through our court system called the Self-Help Center. It has a whole section on domestic violence and how to do a protective order. All of the forms are there. This is the graph that the court system provides about how to get a protection order in Alaska. And in looking at it, as someone who has done this work for very long, I think I would find that very intimidating, and it's somewhat Kafka-esque, I believe. So perhaps that's one answer, Representative Gray, to your question, is it's not a simple process. And certainly if you're pro se, it's not a simple process. Where are the forms? If you want to get a protective order, again, the court system has the forms online and you can download them if you're doing it on your own. All right, so what are we talking about when we talk about civil protective orders? There are three different types: domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. There are also three different types within those different substantive types that you can get, and they are separated by duration. There's an emergency order, which is also called a 72-hour order, because that's how long it's good for. An ex parte order, sometimes called the short-term order, which is good for up to 20 days, often extended if there's a need for that to be extended due to several factors. And then there's also a long-term order, which is the one-year order, which you get after a hearing where the other side has a chance to come in and say their position on what's going on. This long-term order can be extended, as Ms. Booch addressed in her testimony. The emergency order must be requested by law enforcement. It is good, as I said, for 72 hours. There is no notice to the respondent given in these cases. And the standard that the law enforcement officer must show to the court is that there's been a recent commission of domestic violence and probable cause to believe that the victim is in immediate danger. So this is a remedy that was put in place really for the situation where survivor can't go to the courthouse. It's the weekend. Maybe we're in a rural area. The respondent is not maybe on the scene. They've left the scene of the crime. So an arrest can't be made. And a law enforcement officer believes that this victim really needs help. So they're able to call the magistrate and ask the magistrate or the judge who's on call that weekend to issue this order. And it's enough time for the survivor to then be able to get to the courthouse on Monday morning to get a short-term order. The ex parte order is kind of the next phase, and none of these orders are mutually exclusive. They can build upon each other. You can get all three. So who can apply for that? The victim can apply on their own behalf, or a minor. So if you're a parent or a guardian or someone appointed by the court on behalf of a minor child, you can apply. No notice to the respondent, again, is required at that point, but they will get notice of it once it's issued. And then that is good for 20 days, unless dissolved earlier by the court. And the standard is probable cause to believe that domestic violence occurred, and it's necessary to protect the petitioner, and the petitioner certifies in writing that they have made, that whether or not they've made an attempt to notify the respondent. So a little bit higher burden of proof here, where not only does it have to be like reasonably seem like domestic violence has occurred, but also there has to be some imminency of immediate harm to get that, like, you know, short-term order in effect from the court. Probable cause is our lowest standard of proof, pretty much. So still should be somewhat easy to get it, but clearly we see it's not. And then who? For the long-term order, this is the one-year order. Who can do it? Again, it's the victim or a minor. Notice does have to be given in this case to the respondent, and that's where there will be a full hearing. They have to have 10 days notice. The respondent must have 10 days notice in order for them to have enough time to prepare for the hearing, get counsel if they can afford it, get their evidence together. And then the hearing, the order will expire 1 year after the date it's issued, unless it is extended. Those extensions, which were passed in 2019 by the legislature, include you have to do it 30 days prior to when your order expires or 60 days after the order has expired. So there's a 90-day window to ask for that one-year extension. And the standard for the extension is that it has to be necessary to protect the petitioner from continued domestic violence. And the standard for getting a protective order, the initial one-year protective order, is that a crime of domestic violence occurred by a preponderance of the evidence. So that is a different standard than our very high beyond a reasonable doubt standard in the criminal context. It's more likely than not, a judge has to find more likely than not that the crime of domestic violence occurred. So you might see what we call them criminal civil companion cases, where the same assault perhaps is the subject of a criminal case that is going through the criminal justice system, where a prosecutor must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that assault occurred. And the remedy that will happen is incarceration or, fines, while at the same time, the victim on their own has gone to get a protection order, and they have to prove just beyond or preponderance of the evidence of that assault to get a whole range of remedies. Basically, two requirements for proving what you have to prove to get the long-term hearing. You have to show that there was a relationship, a household relationship for the domestic violence order, and you have to prove that a crime of domestic violence occurred. I keep saying those words, and I'm going to expand upon this just briefly. Proving the relationship, we have a fairly broad statute in terms of the types of intimate partner or familial relationships that can get a protective order. Includes spouses, people who have lived together, people who have a child in common. And then our crimes of domestic violence are also fairly broad. They include many crimes in our criminal code. They are the criminal definitions that we use, but we have to prove them in the civil context. And it has been expanded somewhat over the last few years, including last year, you included interference with reporting a domestic violence crime and unlawful contact. Does the crime have to be reported to law enforcement? Absolutely not. This is, again, a process that the victim can do on their own. However, I think it's important to note that often law enforcement use this as a tool in their toolbox. If they get to the scene of a DV and they don't feel like they have enough to make a probable cause arrest, they will tell people to go to the courthouse and get a civil protective order. And so it may be that there are people going to the courthouse who really don't have what is necessary to get a protective order, but they're being sent there by the police, who are kind of like, we want to offer you some remedy, but we can't make an arrest based on what we've seen or know tonight. All right, what are the remedies you can get in a civil protective order? The remedies become more, I would say, strict and perhaps burdensome, or that's the wrong word. I don't like that word, but the remedies change as the notice and opportunity to heard to the respondent gets greater. So in the beginning, with the emergency and the ex parte order, really, we're looking at immediate safety. Let's secure, let's make this as safe as possible for the victim. And so the remedies available in the ex parte and the emergency order, which are also available in the long term, include no threatening to commit or committing domestic violence, stalking, or harassment. That is just don't do bad behavior. And that is in effect, actually, that is the one provision in our orders that is in effect forever and does not terminate, unless somebody comes back to court and dismisses the order. The rest of the remedies end when the protective order ends. And that includes no direct or indirect contact with the petitioner, removing the respondents from the residence of the petitioner or their shared residence, staying away from other places frequented by the petitioner, such as school or work or grocery stores that they both go to, possession and use of vehicles and or pets, and law enforcement assistance, which is really like enforcing the order or getting a writ of assistance from law enforcement. In the ex parte or the 20-day order and the long-term only, you can get all of what I just said above, plus child custody, child support, and the respondent should not be consuming controlled substances. And then only in the long-term order, again, only after the respondent has had an opportunity to come in and say their piece and defend themselves, can you get all of the above plus no use or possession of a deadly weapon if it was used in the commission of the domestic violence, direct the respondent to surrender firearms owned or possessed if they actually possessed or used a firearm in the commission of the domestic violence, respond to or pay the petitioner for expenses associated with the domestic violence, including medical costs or household damage, pay the petitioner's costs and fees in bringing the protective order, including the cost of hiring an attorney if they actually are able to do that, and then domestic violence prevention or substance abuse treatment programs for a respondent, a certified batterers program or a substance abuse program. And then there's a catch-all relief process or catch-all relief remedy for civil protective orders, which is anything else the court thinks is important to protect the petitioner. I'll just briefly mention that we also have stalking and sexual assault protective orders, which in the last 15 years or so were enacted by the legislature because there was a world of people who didn't have a household relationship and needed to get protection because they had been sexually assaulted or stalked. And so that process is specifically for them to get a protective order. You don't have to prove a relationship, but the remedies are more limited. General provisions for all protective orders include there cannot be a filing fee or any cost really that is borne by the petitioner in bringing the action. The petitioner can make contact, and that does not void an order, but clearly if the respondent does, that would be a violation of the order. Parties may not be ordered into mediation or other alternative dispute resolution, which could happen in a family law process, and that's why that restriction is there. Protective orders are generally heard by our magistrate judges, although in some locations they could be consolidated with a family law case if there's a divorce or custody case that is filed. And they can be, as we said, extended for 1 year if necessary. And then enforcement. I mean, I think there was a question to Dr. Johnson in terms of effectiveness. We know that these orders are only effective if they are enforceable. What do you need for enforcement? You need law enforcement to be able to come and respond to it. You need a very clear and specific order that does not leave gray areas, because law enforcement does not like gray areas in enforcing a protective order, because a prosecutor has to bring that to criminal court and prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that violation happened. And so it has to be a very clear order. And I would be remiss not to say that we have problems with enforcements, that it can be you need persistence sometimes to enforce an order, repeated calls, and that can be a problem. Anything other than the no contact provisions of the protective order are enforceable by what we call civil contempt, meaning the petitioner has to go back to court and say, hey, judge, you issued this visitation order. And it says he's only allowed to contact me about visitation, but he's contacting me about who I'm dating and what I'm wearing at the exchanges. And it's really difficult, and I'd like that to be changed, and I'd like him to be held in contempt, which doesn't do a lot other than the judge will hopefully have a hearing on that and maybe issue a change in the order and give some stern a warning to the respondent, and maybe there'll be some type of civil fine. This is just kind of how law enforcement is involved in protective orders on this slide. They are important in serving the process, very important. And a unserved protective order is not enforceable. So getting service on our respondents can be challenging at times. Once they do that, they enter it into a civil registry of protective orders, which can really help with enforcement and help with interstate enforcement of protective orders. And then they also are obviously involved in the process of enforcing of the long-term orders. As I said, having an attorney makes a huge difference in these cases. And we know that still we have very little ability to provide that in the civil legal world. But we know that when a victim has an attorney, that they are much more likely to prevail. Why is that? It's much easier to present your evidence. It's much easier to present your exhibits. These protective order hearings are mini trials. And we expect people who are survivors who have gone through a very traumatic thing in their life to go into court and know how to put together an exhibit list and how to interview witnesses and do this within 10-foot proximity to the person who has been abusive to them. So it is a really difficult process for people, and having an attorney is critically important to ending the cycle of abuse for people. All right, more safety for victims. What are some thoughts that we have had over the years? And certainly, you know, after hearing Ms. Booch and like the things that she has so bravely brought forth, I think, in terms of what is important to moving forward in these areas. One of the issues we've seen repeatedly around the state is that when there's an ex parte hearing, some courts in Alaska or an ex parte order is requested. The process for that is the petitioner fills out the petition, it gets sent to the court, and then some areas hold hearings and then some areas do not. The problem we see is if the court does not hold a hearing on that protective order and they deny it, then that can be really harmful because some people just don't present well on paper. Either English is not their first language, they may have a challenge with writing or reading, they don't know what information to put in there, that is important. They don't know clearly what the law is. And so ex parte petitions are denied without a person getting to articulate their fear, and it's only done in writing. So we believe that it's important if a court is going to deny a ex parte protective order that they hold a hearing and hear from the petitioner before they do that. Consider extending the duration of protective orders post 1 year. So again, Ms. Booch addressed this, and my research shows that we are among the bottom in states in terms of how long we allow protective orders to be in effect. So from 2024, I looked at a state-by-state survey of the duration of protective orders. We are in the bottom 11 of states in terms of our duration, with West Virginia and Michigan being the two states less than Alaska in terms of less than 1 year. There's 9 other states that allow for 1 year protective orders. 14 states allow for 2 year protective orders. 11 states allow for permanent protective orders with certain conditions to how you can undo that. 2 states allow for 10-year protective orders, 4 states, 5-year protective orders, 7 states, 3 or 4-year protective orders, and then 5 states have what looks like to be like an unspecified period of time where it's left to the court's discretion. Prohibit prevailing respondents from getting attorney's fees, specifically in the stalking and sexual assault arena. There is a world of cases where courts are allowing prevailing respondents to get attorney's fees when the petitioner does not get the protective order. So sexual assault victim goes to court, they have a hearing, they can't convince the judge that a sexual assault occurred, the respondent has hired an attorney, and they now ask the sexual assault survivor to pay their attorney's fees. And those types of fee awards have been granted. There actually is legislation pending. Currently, it's SB 49 and HB 222 that would close that loophole, and we think that's very important. provide for an ex parte hearing process in extension cases. I want to thank Vice Chair Kopp for his work in getting the extensions done in 2019. There is one loophole where if you're asking for your extension after your order has expired in that 60-day window, and there's no way to get a short-term order. So you'll go ask for the hearing and you're unprotected basically until you can get the long-term hearing extended. So we think there needs to be an ex parte process there. Provide that award of temporary custody to the petitioner includes physical and legal custody. Right now, the remedy just says award temporary custody to the petitioner. It doesn't specify physical and legal. Legal is decision-making custody of over children. Physical is who has the kids. And what we find is that if you don't clearly have legal custody, there may be a requirement where you're forced to talk to the respondent about what school your child is going to go to, or what type of medical care your child needs. And so clearing that up would be helpful for petitioners. Consider more teeth to the state firearms restrictions, including a statutory law enforcement writ of assistance to collect firearms. Our remedy for firearms, again, if it's used in the commission only of the domestic violence under state law, can the state take your firearms? But it asks the respondent to surrender them, and a clear writ of assistance to law enforcement would be probably much, much more helpful to survivors where firearms are really a high lethality risk. And then allow petitioners to file through email for state court electronic filing systems. This may not be a remedy for the legislature, but there's a new electronic database called True Filing that the court system has instituted in the last year. And for people who are getting protective orders, and are doing the process on their own, they no longer can email the petition into their local court system. They have to register as a True Filer, get a password and go into the True File system, and then upload their petition into that system. And it just adds one more burdensome process for people who already maybe only have access to a phone to be able to get that protective order to the court system. So we think emailing should remain an option for survivors. And then this is just a snapshot of how the legislature over the last many, many years has amended the protective order process, including the 1996 overhaul of the law, which really very significantly changed our domestic violence process, to the 2019 extensions. And I think that's it. And I really appreciate, again, you taking so much time to listen to this presentation and to be a little bit more educated about protective orders, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for this very thorough presentation. It's good to see the differences. But my question is, how do we treat minors differently when they have to seek a protective order?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Vance. So a minor cannot ask for a protective order on their own. They have to do so with a parent or a guardian or someone who has been appointed by the court. So a 16-year-old cannot go into court and on their own ask for a protective order.
Follow up. Well, the reason I ask is that I have a constituent, a minor, a grade schooler, who was assaulted by another minor, and the minor who assaulted the victim, the father was in I'll just say a position of authority, and the minor victim had to go in and stand there in court with the minor who assaulted her and the father who is in a position of authority. And, you know, we've been trying to do work around protecting victims, especially minors, from further trauma. And I was wondering, you know, what work your organization has done on this, and what insight you could provide us on how we could better protect minors from being re-victimized through this process.
Ms. Payton.
Thank you, Representative Vance, through the chair. Those are incredibly difficult situations. You know, anyone under 18 does not have the ability to contract, so they can't they can't go forth, get an attorney, and go get a protective order. The court could appoint a guardian ad litem for that person in that situation, and that might be a good remedy, asking the court to make that appointment. I know that our member programs' hands are tied in terms of what types of services at times they can provide to minors without the parents' permission. And those are areas where the Office of Children's Services, we really hope, are stepping in and protecting that minor and doing more on the minor's behalf.
Follow up. My apologies for a lack of clarification. This minor had parents involved, but the parent told me that their minor daughter still had to stand there in the courtroom to seek this protective order, and was appalled by the process of why we weren't doing more to protect them and the vulnerability that they feel as a child in the courts. And I know that the network helps as much as possible, but just thought that there might be more insight on even the minor victims who have parents involved and are trying to do their best feel like our system is not helping them.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Vance. It is, if a minor is the direct victim of the crime of domestic violence, it can be really difficult to do anything but have that person who is the victim there testifying because of what hearsay issues with presenting evidence. But there are situations where perhaps a court could appoint a guardian ad litem to talk with that child and present the evidence. But we certainly do hear and know that that happens, and it's not a great process at all. Thank you.
Representative Underwood.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, do you, or has your, not department, but who you work for, do you know if there's been any advocacy done when it comes to back to kind of what Ms. Booch was talking about putting responsibility back on the respondent, like requiring their proof of rehabilitation, or not having the courts necessarily just dismiss or terminate or modify the case automatically without that kind of proof? Do you know if there's been any work that's been done just to protect victims in that case, that it's just not an automatic dismissal, just to shift that burden? This is kind of newer to me, so I'm just wondering if you know of any past advocacy for that. It sounds like it's just like a quick statute change, like a couple words. I just don't know if there's been any work or advocacy around that.
Yeah, through the chair, thank you, Representative Underwood. I don't know that there has been legislative advocacy from the network to do that. I would say that that is something that is in effect in our custody laws and the rebuttable presumption. In order to, if there's domestic violence, the court has to make findings of it. And if there's two or more acts, the abusive parent does not get custody of the kids unless they can show a menu of things. And it is their burden to come back and do that in the custody world. And that is something we have always advocated for, in addition to advocating for that legislation in 2004. So I think there's precedent for it in the law. And in certain cases, it seems like it would be a very helpful thing. And I appreciate Ms. Booch bringing it forward.
Yeah. Thank you. It's just same thing. I was just thinking about it in the same realm of custody. It seems like I know of multiple parents that have gotten rightfully, wrongfully accused of something, but the proof is on them to continually go and do the classes and do all the things that they're required to prove that they are acceptable for having children again, you'd kind of think that they would take that approach for the CPOs to have the respondent prove that they are not doing these behaviors anymore and not keep re-victimizing the victim. Just a comment, not a question.
Thank you, Representative Underwood. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I know you mentioned earlier about language being a barrier for petitioners. Could you speak more about what assistance is out there? I know that the courts and the state will have language translations services, but just a little bit more detail about how people are accessing those translation services or their interpreter services. And I'm just thinking about, like, you know, who are the folks who aren't fluent English speakers who aren't accessing this at all because it's such a convoluted process and they can't understand English.
Yeah, through the chair. Thank you, Representative Mina. The court system does have some of the forms translated. We at the network absolutely use interpreters when we are working with survivors. So it's really the people who aren't able to access who we're most concerned about, who may be less likely to call law enforcement. And that includes both our traditional languages, of Yupik or other traditional speakers, and people who English is not their first language. We work closely with the Language Interpreter Center in Anchorage to make sure that people that we work with, including our member programs, have accessibility.
Follow up. Through the chair, do you also have other Alaska Native languages besides Yupik?
I know that the Language Interpreter Center does. I don't know that the forms are available in other languages on the court system's website. I can't remember what languages those are, but I know that they do.
Thank you.
Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, a question. How often in Alaska do we see situations where a person petitions for a civil protective order and then the respondent within a very short time period, I don't want to use the word retaliates, but files their own petition for a civil protective order against the original petitioner. Is that a common situation here in Alaska?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Eichheit, that's a great question. I would say very frequently, and we probably see it in our program more so because a lot of our cases are when somebody's reached out, they are perhaps ready to move forward, and they may be filing a family law case also. I would say retaliation might happen in several ways. Through the court system, it could happen through going to modify the order immediately. An ex parte order can be modified, as can the long term, but a judge is required to hold a hearing on 3 days' notice. And often what we see is, again, the respondent, who more often has access to resources, will hire an attorney to come in, modify that order, try to extend the civil protective order and try to get their case dismissed if there's a criminal case going on, a criminal companion case, and then file a divorce custody action and try to get interim custody and take everything out of civil protection order court. So a lot of legal maneuvering from respondents if a civil protective order is issued immediately. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question, Ms. Pate, about domestic violence prevention programs, batterers programs. Two questions. How successful are they and how available are they in Alaska?
Yeah, that's a great question, Representative Gray. I know Ms. Stanfield's there in the room, too. She may have a thing or two to say about this. We do not have a lot of programs, certified programs in the state. The ones that are certified are found on the website on the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. They tend to be in our larger areas, Anchorage or regional hubs. So people in rural areas do not have as much accessibility. And we need more programs, I would say. And how successful are they? It really depends on a person's desire to change and work the program. What we think about when we're talking about success of a domestic violence intervention program or a batterer's program is safety for the victim. They have to be safe and the victim's safety needs to be maintained. So that program needs to be working with a member program, one of our DV programs, to make sure that through this very tender and dangerous time of separation, safety is being maintained. And two, that the batterer is held accountable. That they are being held accountable to go to those sessions, that they are not able to do an alternate program, and that they want to change. They have to want to change. It's like a substance abuse program. You have to want to change in order for it to be effective.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee? I'm going to ask Ms. Pate, if you can leave, can you leave this slide up? I'd like to call Ms. Bucha up one more time.
Do I need to state my name?
Yes.
Yeah. My name is Laura Booch.
Thank you. So you can see from the slide, Ms. Booch, that like we had these 90-day protective orders, and then we went up to 6 months, and then we went up to a year. And I'm curious, like, we have, like, Ms. Pate went through all of the different states and all the different ways that they do it. It just seems to me, if I'm honest about what would be Alaska's next step, it would be to go to a 2-year to allow for 2 years. Would that be enough to make a difference for you?
It would be a start. You know, filing the protective order was the last resort for me. And, you know, having 2 years in between would certainly improve it. But last year when I had to refile, it was June, and that triggered escalations that have only recently wrapped up in court just a couple weeks ago. So, I mean, it would be great, but I think that, you know, if it is as simple as changing a few words and having it be similar to, you know, the custody presumption, that would certainly make things a lot less stressful, at least from my perspective.
Thank you. Any questions from committee? Thank you so much for coming back up.
Yes, thank you.
Since Ms. Stanfield is here, do you have anything you want to say?
You know, when given that opportunity, I always have something to say. Brenda Stanfield, Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And again, thank you so much for holding this today. And as you were asking the question about, you know, what kind of advocacy has happened, I was sharing with Ms. Booch earlier that sometimes it's so right in front of your face and you don't see it. And so I think as advocates, it is so important that Ms. Booch, who has been so brave to share her story, reminds us that just because we solved something in 2019 that we were so proud of, like, okay, we can get these extensions, doesn't mean the work is done, that we have to continue doing it. So I think that this is really bringing to our attention when Ms. Booch just said it's just wrapping up, and my brain said, wait, June is right around the corner. And if she has to start 30 days before, that's May, we're in March. That means she gets a 6-week reprieve in her brain from doing this. And so when you say like 2 years, I'm thinking, I don't know if that's enough. You know, maybe we should be looking at this in a different light, where in the rebuttable presumption, unless I prove that I did the 3 things that I was required to do, I don't get the ability to return to the courts and say, let's look at this different. And so I think really looking at this in a manner that is outside of our current thinking may be a really good idea. So I really appreciate the comments here. The batterers intervention programs, I will just remind people that those were funded with $250,000 back in 1998. I was one of those grantees, and I was so excited that I got, you know, $30,000 to do this program, that has not increased. In fact, that line item went away. There's not even a designated pot of money for batterers intervention programs anymore. They're just using the general funds of what could be used for victim services to still try to, I'm going to say, limp the programs along, because you have to have a certain level of funding to get who you need in there to do these programs. People who are sent to these programs, we also don't have many of them are on formal parole or something that would have a probation officer. So most of the time they're on court-ordered probation, which is the courts are supervising them. That means the programs have to have the administrative capacity to go back to the court to say they didn't show up, they haven't been coming, they haven't been coming. They have, the district attorney's office has to be willing to file the probation violation, and then they have to get it back into court and they have to be served. So all of these pieces have to fall into place. And we have really learned a lot about the accountability piece. The more things we order and then don't follow through on, the more emboldened people get. So I think that if you can get people to these programs are amazing. Like, if you have not had an opportunity to go visit your local program, if you have one, I would encourage you to, because the sharing that goes on and the conversations that happen between the men in that room, many of them, this is the first time they're kind of figuring out that their thinking isn't quite right, because it's maybe what they learned. It's what they've grown up with, and it's what's been acceptable for a long time. These programs can make a difference, but again, sometimes you got to have a bit of a stick to get them in there. They don't normally, we had very few self-referrals coming into this program. Most of them were being sent there because of some type of court involvement. So again, I just thank you for the opportunity to share these today and for your questions.
Representative Underwood.
Thank you, through the chair. Do you think that if there was a statutory change that would make it like the custody issues where the perpetrator basically is having to prove that they have corrected their behavior, that there would be more attendance and there are more self-referrals to these types of programs?
Through the chair, Representative Underwood, yes, I do feel like if that was part of a protective order that said, hey, until you finish this program, we're going to consider that you're still dangerous to your family and to your children, and then that order was to go through until they finish that, which usually, depending on the program, it can be anywhere from 6 to 9 months. We had one that used to be a year, but they've shortened it back up. And so within a 1 year order, someone could finish that program if they were going to, but oftentimes we don't see them actually complete that. There's a lot of self-reflection that has to happen, but yes, that could be something to say until this is completed. Or the substance abuse treatment, a lot of times that is ordered, but they don't do that either. And so oftentimes when that 1 year comes up, really nothing on there has been done that maybe they've been advised or requested. And I would have to go back to Christine Pate to say, you know, how often are they saying go to a batterer's intervention program in a restraining order? That's usually more the custody side of it. So normally they're saying refrain from drugs and alcohol, refrain from abuse, but they're not necessarily saying attend or complete in the protective order hearings.
So then if they're not doing that, how it is currently, to my understanding, is the court can still dissolve it even if they didn't do what they were supposed to do.
Through the chair, Representative Underwood, it's going to automatically dissolve in that 1 year if they don't file to have it extended within the 30 days up front or the 60 days after. And the 60 days after means it's already dissolved. And that's what Ms. Pate was referring to, is that they can't go back and get a 20-day order. So when they go back in the 60-day window, they have to start over again with notification. So they may be without a protective order for a period of time, but there is nothing right now that would keep that active.
And again, that's the victim having to go back and continue to refile.
Through the chair, yes, that's always the person, and they're petitioner and respondent in there. And so the petitioner has to go back each time.
I'll follow up on Representative Underwood's line of questioning. So if we change the law that, you know, in these domestic violence civil protective orders, they were required to do a batterers intervention program, and we have 7,900 CPO cases in a year. I mean, will we have capacity for all those people who now have the stick? They have to do this if they want it to go away. I mean, will we be able to meet that need?
Through the chair right now, or I'm sorry, to the chair right now, we have programs. Oftentimes these programs are not big. If you had people who were coming in who were paying fees to come to those, then it is possible that you could build the capacity. I mean, it wouldn't be an immediate, like if every judge started doing that right now, yes, we would have a problem. The other thing is we're working with Department of Corrections to try to figure out the funding and the budgeting under that. Also for those who are on probation and parole. So I do believe it could scale up today. No.
I like what you said, though. The respondents would pay for it. Zero fiscal note. Yeah. We don't pay for it. The respondents pay for it. Yeah. Any other questions? Representative Underwood.
Sorry. I'm talking a lot today. Through the chair, kind of on that same thought, though, it's if we change the law that it wouldn't dissolve automatically, they wouldn't necessarily be going to the classes. They would have to get themselves in the classes if they ever wanted to have that expunged. So it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to have 7,900 people all of a sudden flooding these classes. The responsibility would still be on the respondent to have to go and do that. Otherwise, they're going to have to stay under that CPO until they do the work. So,
and I'll follow up with Ms. Pate. So I assume that the carrot toward wanting to have that indefinite civil protective order dissolved is that they can get their guns back. Is that the carrot?
Well, it depends if guns have been taken. So there's both state law and federal law for taking firearms. Under state law, the court can only order firearms to be taken if that firearm was used in the commission of the crime. Under federal law, if it's a specific household relationship and the respondent presents a credible threat to the petitioner, federal law says that they're supposed to take their firearm, but that would be the feds that would take that firearm. So there's both legally whether the protective order prohibits the respondent from having a firearm, and then enforcement of that as to whether it's state or federal law. What we find is that very few firearms are ordered to be taken and then actually taken, enforced by being taken. Under the federal laws, there's very few ATF agents, and those are the people who are supposed to take the guns, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. So even if a order complies with federal law for taking the firearms, they are rarely taken. Under state law, it's the troopers or law enforcement who would take the guns. And that's where I was pointing out that there's not clear language, it seems like, in the statute that is clearly directs law enforcement to be directed. It's more the respondent is supposed to surrender the firearm versus law enforcement needs to take these firearms.
So to me, there's a silver lining that we're not removing the firearms, because then there is no motivation and they could just allow that indefinite civil protective order to last forever if we made them indefinite and they had to do a certain number of criteria to get it removed and they've kept their firearms, then maybe they live hundreds of miles away and they just are like, I don't care, keep that civil protective order forever. Is that something? Am I missing anything there?
The only thing you're missing is they couldn't purchase a new firearm if the protective order continues to be in effect, because they'll get flagged. They'll get a red flag from the system to show that they have a valid protective order that is against them. The remedy for that is they can go to court and dismiss the protective order and show that they've done a batterers program. Mm-hmm. So they have the tools in their toolbox, so to speak, to do it.
Thank you. Sure. Ms. Booch.
Thank you. This is Laura Booch again. I just wanted to kind of tap on the the question that you had brought up, because part of the issue with having to renew this isn't just the cost to me personally, but we take up a lot of court time and a lot of resources. And I've had 3 different writs of assistance where I've had to wait with officers to come and try and execute that. And there was a gun on the final one, and they still didn't collect it because it wasn't serialized and he'd removed it from the property. So it's not, I mean, guns are what they are here in Alaska, but the biggest thing would just be not tying up all of the court resources, all of the, you know, the law enforcement resources, and just letting, you know, putting it on them. So.
Thank you. Yes.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
Thank you. I feel that there's legislation coming, and or at least expanding current legislation. But I anticipate that there are significant due process considerations in this. And at that next hearing, if you could have someone from the Department of Law, and maybe have legislative research look at the commission the Judicial Commission that takes a look at some of the crime data that could provide some answers for us of, you know, what are the implications of giving a longer than 1 year? Maybe are there other states that have looked at giving the courts a discretion of in between 1 and 5 years? You know, what kind of due process is concerned there? And, you know, having some hard data that helps us kind of wade through this, because the last thing that we want is more unnecessary litigation. And Alaskans take their firearms very seriously because, like you said, someone could be hundreds of miles away, but maybe need to go hunt, provide food. And we want to make sure that we are walking that line very well, but also, as Ms. Booch said, is making it where she doesn't have to go in and prove every time that she needs to extend that maybe we could flip that script, but make sure that we're protecting the due process concerns at the same time. I think it's possible, but I think we're going to have some people in the room to help us maneuver through that, because I think there's a lot of case law that will be supportive of some of these things that we have in mind.
Thank you, Representative Vance. We can do that. I'll just say that we should also do like an advertising campaign that if you victimize your significant other, that you may lose your guns, and like just making sure that Alaskans know that when you treat your spouse this way, you'll lose your guns and you may not be able to go subsistence hunt because you were beating up your wife. Like, we can make that more clear throughout the state. Yeah, sorry. Any other comments from...
Can I? Yeah, sure. Oh, I'm sorry. I just
Ms. Booch and Representative Vance.
I'm so sorry. This is Laura Booch again. Just about the DVIP program that you had mentioned. The judge in my case used discretion in relation to the custody and allowed him to do, like, to try doing a year of counseling instead before. So I don't think it would be impossible to allow the judge to have discretion in something like that, as far as like if he doesn't have availability for a DVIP course or there aren't the resources for it, but somebody is really actually motivated to go through the process and better, you know, do better, then, you know, maybe it would be other options.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
I do have one final question for clarification on the network's presentation. It showed the number of sexual assault protective orders, and that number seemed very low to me. It's in the 30s compared to all the others. Maybe Ms. Stanfield has an answer as to why that is. Are they often classified under the DV instead of the SA, or is it simply because there are fewer people seeking the sexual assault protective orders? Do you have an answer why there's such a disparity in that number?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, it would be speculation on my part, but oftentimes when there is a relationship, maybe a dating relationship, different things, they may get the domestic violence restraining order. I'm going to say there's just a lot of stigma with sexual assault. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's a lot of stigma with domestic violence also, but there's a lot of stigma with sexual assault. And then sexual assault tends to be in the criminal arena already, where domestic violence isn't always in the criminal arena. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes with a sexual assault, they may be able to get some protections based upon what's set up as a victim in court, and they may not feel the same need for the protective orders. We actually have been surprised through the network that they are as low as they are. But again, just anecdotal in my own opinion, I don't believe there's been, of course, the UAA may have done some research on this and know a better answer.
Ms. Pate, do you agree with Ms. Stanfield's assessment?
Yes, I would say that that is true. I think it's incredibly hard to go into court and talk about your sexual assault. Especially if you don't have an attorney, if there was ever an area where a right to counsel was important, I would say it's in the sexual assault protective order realm. It's crazy that somebody has to do that on their own without attorney assistance. And while, again, we appreciate our criminal justice partners, we still have a long way to go to prosecuting sexual assault in this state. And so often it's the people who the criminal case is not moving forward who end up in civil protective order court. I think a lot of people don't know about it also. They may not know that they can do that. And then clearly, if there's a household relationship, they are going to be doing it through the domestic violence protective order realm. But even with the great changes that occurred to our consent laws a few years ago, it's still really hard to prove sexual assault in our courtrooms.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
One more follow-up, and this is just to build on what the further conversation that we're going to have is. I know that in a lot of times when there has been criminal charges and someone is getting out of prison, that fear comes back again of contact. And that's often a time that people are seeking a protective order. Is there any more that we need to consider around those type of circumstances that we could improve this process in relationship to when someone is getting out of prison? And I know that in some cases the victim will be contacted. It's not always the case. At what point could they start that process, and how can we improve that?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, we do try to get, and the Department of Law tries also to make sure everybody signed up for VineLink and that they're getting all those notifications. But I would like to defer this question to Ms. Pate, if that would be okay with you all, to say specifically, she's probably seen this a bit more than I have. Christine, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Vance. So part of the less known changes to the 2019 law included some language change, which I think is important in this context, where it used to be you had to prove a fresh incident, a fresh crime of domestic violence, if you wanted to get a protective order. The 2019 statutory change says it can be based on past domestic violence if it seems like the current situation makes the petitioner continue to be concerned for their safety. So in your situation, that petitioner could say, hey, my partner assaulted me terribly 5 years ago. They've been incarcerated. They are just getting out now. And I am absolutely terrified. And I would hope that that person would get a protective order. There's also a part of the language in the protective order statute that says a court cannot deny a protective order solely based on the lapse of time between when the crime of domestic violence occurred and when the petition is being sought.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions or comments from committee members, I want to thank all of our presenters today, Ms. Booch, Dr. Johnson, Ms. Pate, and Ms. Stanfield, for their time and sharing their expertise with this committee. That concludes today's business before the committee. Before we adjourn, we have two quick reminders. The amendment deadline for House Bill 211, Insurance Prepaid Legal Plans, is tonight, Monday, March 9th at 11:59 p.m. The amendment deadline for House Bill 316, a just damages limit, personal injury, wrongful death, is Wednesday, March 11th at 11:59 p.m. The time is now 2:40 p.m., and this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.